All right, my name's Stephanie. I am an alcoholic.
Hi.
So the first time I ever told my story, my sponsor prepped me on how to do it. And what she told me to do was to give you my sobriety date, which is October 15th, 1998. And she also told me to read something, to say the third step prayer with someone, which I did. And then to read something to get myself centered, to make sure that I was enough outside of self that I could be of service. So I'm choosing chapter 11, A Vision for You. For most normal folks, drinking means companionship and colorful imagination. It means release from care, boredom, and worry. It is joyous intimacy with friends and a feeling that life is good, but not so with us in those last days of heavy drinking. The old pleasure were gone. They were but memories. Never could we recapture the great moments of the past. There was an insistent yearning to enjoy life as we once did and a heartbreaking obsession that some new miracle of control would enable us to do it. There was always one more attempt and one more failure. The less people tolerated us, the more we withdrew from society, from life itself. As we became subjects of king alcohol, shivering denizens of mad realm, the chilling vapor that is loneliness settled down. It thickened, ever becoming blacker. Some of us sought out sordid places, hoping to find understanding, companionship, and approval. Momentarily, we did. Then would come oblivion, and the awful awakening to face the hideous four horsemen. Terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. Unhappy drinkers who read this page will understand. Yeah, nice start, huh? and that is where alcohol took me. I walked into my first meeting here in Atlanta, coming straight off a bus. I was dropped off at the Marietta Greyhound bus station. My last drink had actually occurred on that bus. It was a 24-hour bus ride from Florida, where I was. And there was a can of beer that I heard it now, rolling around on the floor a couple seats ahead of me. And I was sure it was beer. I was sure of it. So there was some dude I didn't know sitting in the seat ahead of me on the bus, and I capped him. And I said, "Do you mind if I have a sip of your beer?" And he didn't care. He let me have a sip of his beer. And it was warm, and it was my last drink of alcohol. I got off the bus in Marietta, and I ended up going to a house where I stayed for 2 days, crying in a bed. And then I went to a treatment center. And the woman at the treatment center called my parents, who I hadn't talked to in 5 years, and said, "Your daughter is needing help." And that night, the first thing I ever did was get in a car with a group of women. I had no idea who they were, and they took me to Clarkston. And that was actually my first meeting. There was 5 women there, and the person who told her story, and it was an absurd story, and but I identified with it immediately, because what she described in her story was the four horsemen, the terror, the bewilderment, the frustration, and the despair. And I couldn't believe that there was another person in this world who felt what I felt. And that's what I felt, you know? So, I believe I was born an alcoholic. Born an alcoholic. I have all the traits of an alcoholic. And those traits, I'm learning over time, are different and yet very, very similar for us all. I was adopted into my family when I was 6 months old. I have an older sister who is biological. And from the very beginning, when we talk in this big book about feeling different and lonely, that's where I started. I changed schools every single year of my school career, so it kind of added to it. I never was able to form relationships long term. My relationship with my mom and dad was very strained. However, my parents were very religious. My mom is a Catholic nun. She was kicked out. That's kind of cool. But my dad has his doctorate in theology. My mom actually has 2 masters, one of which is in accounting. My sister now has her master's. She is a master's of English. She got me through school. she did. I'd show up at her house, like, "Can you grade this paper?" And she would help me out. And my family is a very normal family. There was no drug use, there was no physical abuse, there was nothing in my childhood to indicate you know, to that I would turn into an alcoholic. That's why I believe I was born an alcoholic. I grew up in the Methodist religion. Methodist was, it's a very, it's not like fire and damnation, you know. I'm going to a Baptist church now, you know, because you can hear messages from everywhere. And I like the music. But anyway, I do. But it's a very fire and brimstone message, and that's not what I grew up with. You know, I didn't have shame and guilt as a part of my religion. However, this alcoholic mind was, it was shame and guilt. My parents literally have told me that they led my Sunday school classes throughout my childhood so that the shame and guilt message would not be present. However, this alcoholic mind grabbed a hold of that, and my God was a big God that I could never live up to. And when I was 14, they do a confirmation where you're going to confirm what you believe to the church. And my mom said, and I don't remember this, but my mom said that I came home and said, you know, I'm not ready to make that commitment. So at age 14, you know, before I ever really got active in my alcoholism, I was already like, you know what, this shit ain't working for me, you know. Yeah. So my first drink was a blackout drunk, and it's insane. I wanted to know what alcohol was like, and I was a fear-driven person. You know, I didn't have relationships, wasn't secure in who I was, and so I wanted to know the effects of alcohol, but I was scared to do it in front of people. How alcoholic. And so I had a friend he had a full bar, and I said, hey, will you get me a bottle? And he hit it, and I climbed out my bedroom window, and I went and I got the bottle, and I came back to my house, and I drank alone in my room. The reason that I know it was a blackout is because I was like, I'm going to see. And I put, I mean, this is so insane. I put a notebook on my night table, and I was writing, you know, every few minutes I'd take a drink and do a little writing. Yeah. I mean, is this normal? It's just not normal. As a person, it's not normal. So, and then when I woke up, yes, I'd had spaghetti. And, yes. And so I had to figure out how I was going to clean that up. And there was writing on the notebook that I didn't even know I did. So I was a walk-around blackout drunk from my very first drink. The spaghetti did not deter me. I continued to drink. And, you know, it didn't start, it wasn't so alcoholic as that. Like, I was able to go, and when I went out with my friends and we were TPing the neighbors, remember the toilet paper and the trees and the, yeah, you're meeting everybody, and I did all that kind of stuff, and I was able to drink little amounts. But, you know, for me, it was very fear-based. It was fear-based. I was afraid of what I would look like, about what I would do, so I never allowed myself to get out of control unless I was alone. I literally, my parents had a cabinet, and when I hear people talk about being, on Wednesday night I went to a meeting and we read the story in the back about the woman who's the housewife drinker, and she said as women were sharing in the meeting, they were sharing about how they would hide their liquor, and they would pour different, you know, things into the liquor canters to show that, you know, that it was filled up and stuff. I would do the same thing. There was peppermint schnapps I did for my parents' cabinet, and I used to put water in it. I had bottles under my bed. I had beer cans under my bed, and we're talking age 14 and 15 years old, you know. When I look back, and this has been, of course, a week of memories, I mean, from the get-go, I was just an alcoholic. I was a drunk, you know. By the time I was 17 years old, I had started, my parents believed in accountability and responsibility, two things that this alcoholic hated, and my grades weren't the best in school. I wasn't a hellion. I was in the marching band. I played saxophone. I played piano. I was in choir. I did jazz band. But I was also smoking weed and, you know, and in drinking. And so by the time I was 17, my parents believed I should get a job. So I went to Papa John's and I got a job, and I was the phone girl on the front desk, and I met my man. He was the manager of a Papa John's, and he was he was the bomb. yeah. And so at age 17, I was once again crawling out the window. And this gentleman introduced me to champagne And that's a giggly, you know, it's not like beer, it's just a little gigglier. And so my parents, they really didn't know what to do with me. And they, you know, my mom ended up trying to, like, for instance, sleep on the couch downstairs because I was sneaking out. Well, I tied bed sheets together, and I swear to you, it was a two-story house with solid brick, and outside my window, and I was getting out the window. You know what I mean? I've, like, had grass stains, but I was hobbling to the car. Yeah. So they really didn't know what to do with me, and I ended up getting married at age 17. Husband number one. And so he got an apartment, and I moved into the apartment, and it was nothing but alcohol. It was just like from the minute I got up in the morning, there was beer in the fridge. You know, I remember walking around in like a robe, and I thought it would be cool because my friends could skip school and come over, you know. Not so, all right. Second time, he was home when somebody came rat-tatting at the door, and he said, "You got to go." And I was like, "What mistake have I made here?" And sure enough, it really was a mistake. I became very isolated. I didn't have a car, so I had no way to get out. So I was pretty much stuck drinking alone in an apartment. He got a promotion, and he got moved down to Dallas, Texas. And Dallas, Texas, I went. Well, hell yeah, let's go to Dallas. And this is really where my alcoholism took off, and this is where I started to disappear from my family, and this is where things just really started to spiral downhill. I was 18 years old. I was in a big city, and I had a car now, and then I started to get employment in bars. And, you know, is it necessary to say what kind of bars? I don't know, but they were bars. And so that's how I made my way. I would not come home at night. I wouldn't. And pills started to be involved a little bit, but I would just disappear. And, you know, with the lifestyle of bars and you're in the big city and I was young, you know, the options are limitless for an alcoholic woman. And I got introduced to dirty martinis. That's a mess. You know, my alcoholism really progressed then. So, you know, I still have about 8 minutes for my bottom. By 7:30, I'm going to get into recovery, I swear. Okay, so terror, bewilderment. You know, from Dallas, Texas, what I have a tendency to do with my drinking and how I hit a bottom so very quickly was, I got sober when I was 22 years old. And when I hear people share their stories, a lot of times I hear about losses. I hear about loss of family. I hear about loss of, you know, getting in trouble with the law, that kind of stuff. And that didn't happen for me because I wasn't old enough to have anything, all right? But and I surrounded myself with people that weren't in college. At age 22, people are in college, they're graduating, they're looking for new jobs. But the people I was hanging out with, it wasn't like that, you know? I never had a home. I went from hotel room to hotel room. I did at one point have a trailer in a field, but the trailer in the field was, you know, outside of the door that I had kicked off. There was a burn barrel where I used to throw my cans and burn my cans. Do you know? I didn't have anything. So as I was traveling, you know, I picked up different men, and that's how I felt safe and not alone. As long as I had somebody that I could party with, then I felt like I was going to be okay. So I ended up being in Florida, and once again I was at a bar. Once again I was living in a hotel. All my belongings were literally in a suitcase, and I was with a man that I actually, some people do know in these rooms. I stayed married to him from the age of 19 till I was about 29. And he actually had been exposed to recovery before, and I didn't know. I had no idea. So we're, you know, we're partying around, and we end up going to somebody's party where they had a card game, and everybody was really drunk. And you know how it is with a group of people that are very drunk. If one bad thing gets said, then everybody's in an uproar. You know, well, something bad got said, and you know the chaos ensued, and pretty soon. We had ridden over to this person's house within their car because we didn't have one. We were, you know, greyhounding it, you know. So, and I would taxi cab it to work. By the way, the guy's name, my taxi cab driver, it was Snake. Yeah, yeah. Snake used to drive me to work. But anyway, so crazy. So we're stuck out here, and we got kicked out of the house. Okay, so I'm literally there with a backpack in the middle of I don't know where, and we're walking, and we have no money, and we're drunk. And it's miserable. It's miserable. We hadn't eaten, because who eats when you're out partying, you know? Nobody eats. I didn't eat. I think we had $2, okay, so we couldn't afford a cab. We go to a gas station, and I don't know about anybody in here. I don't know how broke you've been, but I've been broke. And when you're broke, and you got to eat, you know, then you got to do, like, the hot dogs at the gas station. Come on, people. Nobody in here smiling. Somebody knows about the hot dogs. Okay, thank you. So you put a hot dog, and then you can load as much stuff on it as you can. And if you're really good, you can put two hot dogs, and you load enough stuff on it so nobody knows you got two hot dogs. You only pay for one hot dog. But that's where we were at. We were starving. We decide on the hot dogs, okay? But I'm such an alcoholic mess, and I'm hungry, okay, that you know how it is, Jekyll and Hyde. I couldn't stop that cycle. Do you know? I mean, one minute I would be a happy-go-lucky drunk, and the next minute I would be a raging alcoholic lunatic. I'm sitting there with a hot dog, haven't eaten in a couple days, ain't got no money, have no idea where I'm at, got a backpack on my back, all right, and I take this hot dog and I throw it at the dude. You know what I mean? No food. It was an alcoholic. I mean, who does that? That's me. That's me. And so then I was starving with no place. Yeah, same story, just no food, you know. And it stunk. So I knew that if I called my parents, and I say no contact. I had contacted my parents maybe 2 to 3 times throughout 5 years. And each time my mom would say, I will send you a card for like Kroger, you know. And on those Kroger cards, you can't get cigarettes, you can't, you know, can't get booze. Like, what good is the Kroger card? So my mom had definitely, she'd set decent boundaries around my alcoholism. Never been to Al-Anon a day in her life, you know. You talk about adoption, you talk about God, divine intervention. I have to say that I believe my parents were handpicked by God. So I knew I couldn't call my parents in this predicament. So my gentleman friend called his parents, and she said, there's an uncle that lives close, because we were able to read, you know how you can read on the side of a payphone, the, you know, all that information. So we were able to tell her where we were. And she said, there's an uncle, I'm going to send him your way. So he came. While we were waiting, we were hungry again because I had thrown the hot dog. And he went inside and picked up a sub sandwich, ripped it off, and we sat there outside of a Kroger in the middle of nowhere and ate this poor boy sandwich. Oh, poor boy. Anyway. And we did. And that sucked. So we get in the car with this uncle. We go to a hotel room, and he gives us $20, okay? And he's like, you're going to have to figure out how you're going to get to Marietta, which is where his mother lived. And he had, you know, a paycheck coming and blah, 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 before he didn't show up for work, and there was some money owed to him. So we were going to figure out how we could get that money, get this bus ticket. We're sitting there with $20. And I sat in that hotel room, and I said, there's a gas station right up the road. We need to go get some beer. We need to get beer. And that's my solution. And that literally was all I had for a solution. You know? He said no. He said, I'm going to go to treatment. And I sat there, and he was like, either you're going to go with me, or you can stay here. And it was like a dilemma to me. The reason that I chose treatment was because I was scared of being alone. You know, in the big book, in Bill's story, you know, the assignment that I get or have given or hear about all the time is read Bill's story and underline what you identify with, you know. And one thing that I always get from an alcoholic and what I said is the loneliness. It's so lonely. My fear of loneliness drove me to agree to go to treatments because I needed a break, 3 hots and a cot, you know. I needed to switch my job. I needed to find better employment. It was never to get sober, ever. That $20 ended up being spent on Yeah, dollar store underwear, because I had none. Nobody's laughing. Dollar store underwear sucks. It is a part of a bottom, folks, I'm telling you. But we did. We got, and then we got a toothbrush. And that was about it. That was about it. We did end up getting his paycheck. We were able to get a couple of seats on a MARTA bus or on a Greyhound bus and end up, here in Marietta. There's one thing about my bottom that I want to mention before I move into why we're here. And that is, there was a time when I was in the bars and literally I had to drink Pepto-Bismol side by side with a beer because my stomach was so torn up by alcohol. I couldn't just drink alcohol. And I remember one of those times, and I was looking in the mirror and I could not recognize myself. And I think when I think about people in here and they talk about their bottom, the bottom that they feel and that real bewilderment and the fear and the terror, it was that moment when I looked in that mirror and I was a skeleton of a person. And there was nothing. There was no life. There was no desire. There was nothing there but this little shell of a person. And I remember standing there looking in the mirror and thinking, like, what am I going to do? Who are you? I just couldn't even recognize myself. That moment, I think I identify in everybody in this room. That's the similarity that I feel as we walk the road. I think we all know that moment in time. And yours is colored different than mine, but it's the same. So a couple of other things. I was the drinker who, after the party, I would definitely put a napkin over the cup and I would pour the alcohol in. Cigarette butts would stay the hell out. That's the drunk. There's a lot of bottoms. My alcoholism today, I am 14 years sober. When I sit in a meeting at times, my mind says, Stephanie, you were 22 years old. You were 22. Are you an alcoholic? Are you an alcoholic, really? You didn't have the extra 20 years people talk about. That's where my disease sits. And so for me, I have to remember things like sifting out cigarette butts. I have to remember things like just sitting in that room and wanting to drink instead of, anything else, any other options. There were none. It was alcohol for me. And those are the things I got to remember for this alcoholic. Okay, so Greyhound bus, last drink. I show up at treatment. At treatment, I have a backpack. They have to check my stuff. And I didn't even know what to be embarrassed about, I had no idea what values and principles and walking with integrity and grace. I had no concept of what that was. I was from the street, and yet I wasn't. I had all this background, My parents are like highly educated. I grew up in the church. I know how to play a saxophone. But I'm telling you, I remember in treatment walking through a neighborhood and, because you have 30 minutes where you have to exercise. So we're out there and we're walking in the neighborhood and I'm looking at these houses that have like boats and cars and, trucks and stuff like that. And I'm thinking, how come they can drink like that and they get this stuff? Why couldn't I do that? Yeah. It didn't make sense to me that it wasn't like they didn't drink like I drank. It was, how did they do it successfully? I got exposed to this program through treatment. I don't think I did a whole lot of work in treatment. It gave me a safe place to live because I didn't have the education, the means. I didn't have any way to stay out of the places that I drank. Do you know what I mean? Like, I needed to get myself together, and treatment gave that to me. But AA got me sober. And I did all my work in AA. My first sponsor was from, and my first home group was Skyland University. Oglethorpe University, Skyland Meeting, on Friday nights. And my sponsor, after 2 years, actually fired me for not being serious about the steps, which was intense, very intense for me. I remember crying in Starbucks with my second fourth step, being like, oh my God. She was really wise to do that. My first time, you know, I was a very competitive person. Because I did not belong, I felt like I did not belong in my family. God, throughout my sobriety, has used the defects of character to propel my sobriety. Okay? My sponsor says to me often, Stephanie, you are not a mistake. Your life is not a mistake. You know, you are exactly where you're supposed to be. And when I look back at my sobriety, every weird twist of personality that I've had, God used, you know. I was competitive because I compared myself to my sister, who was the biological child and who I wasn't, all right? So I was competitive. So when I got into treatment, I was the low one on the totem pole. I had no sobriety, no step work, no sponsor. So my competitiveness is the only reason I got a sponsor. It's the only reason I did a four-step, you know? That's the only reason I did it. There was no good, you know, altruistic, I want to get better intentions. It was my sickness that propelled it. However, it got done, you know? So on my fourth step, I remember being kicked up. I had my legs up on the sofa. And I was blessed to go through treatment with a woman who actually walked the streets in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And, man, I was horrified at some of the stuff I'd done, you know? So I remember laying back, my feet are kicked up on the sofa, you know, and we're sitting there, we're exchanging stories about on this fourth step, you know? And she's got me rolling. There are some funny, people are funny. I'll just say that. People are funny. So, you know, with that, you know, I was able to have enough nerve to sit down and be honest with my sponsor, you know? I don't think I would have done that without that experience. My sponsor, she walked into a beginner's meeting. She had 11 years sober when I asked her to be my sponsor. About a year and a half later, I was hearing her speak. I was sitting on the front row, and she said, this woman asked me to be her sponsor when I was at my sickest. And it always makes me want, you know, how sick was I? She was at her sickest moment, I mean. But she was incredible. She was by the book. You guys, she's actually been up here to the Howe Place within the last probably 6 months to tell her story. And she actually took me through the steps for the first time through the 12 and 12. Which was kind of different, but very exciting. And it took a little bit later in my sobriety to get real familiar with the big book. So I was honest with my first four step, and I literally wanted to be like, this is how sick I am. Fix it. Fix it. Like, you think your AA can fix this. Let me show you, you know. And so I put it all out there, you know, put it all out there. Sure as hell this woman was going to be like, I've never seen the likes of you. And boy, was I wrong. I remember I sat there and she told me a story and my mouth dropped, you know. And I always keep that in mind when I do fifth step work, that, you know, it's not just somebody sharing themselves with me. It's the blessing of being able to share myself with somebody else as well. It is an exchange of similarity, you know, that we have all experienced the four hideous horsemen, you know. And she gave that gift to me awesomely. Now, when she fired me at the Starbucks, okay, because I wasn't being serious about my steps, I wasn't. I had already missed an appointment with her, you know. I didn't have my four-step ready. And so, you know, she was right to do it. But I was scared. She sat there and she told me, if you do not go find a woman to tell your four step to, you're going to get drunk. So I was sitting there crying, sad she fired me, and like in fear, like, oh shit, I'm going to walk out of here and drink, you know. So I came up here. Now, my sobriety was centered in Atlanta, but I lived in Woodstock at this point. And, you know, I don't know about you. I like, my ego will do anything to keep me sick, okay? So I wasn't really making my home group down there. I really wasn't meeting up with my sponsor like I should, but I wanted to be like, I ain't up here in Woodstock getting my sobriety either. I'm from Atlanta. Yeah. So I refused to move up here and to center my sobriety here, you know? So when she told me, you're going to get drunk, I went to the first meeting I could find. I found the first woman I could find that would actually want to sit down with me. And I told her my fifth step that very next weekend. It was by far one of the most spiritual fifth steps I've ever done, you know. She was perfectly suited to hear my fifth step. You know, divine intervention all along. And I can tell you honestly, without that woman, I do not believe I would be sober today. Don't believe it, you know. And I think that's how this program works. You know, God uses and weaves our sobriety together so that we all have to do it together. And that's how we work. That's how this program works. It's a we thing, you know. So I gave her my fourth and fifth step, and I stayed sober a little bit longer. My sponsoring other people, didn't really start until probably year five through seven. When I was and then I had a few experience with a few women, not often, but a few. My first woman I sponsored, holy hell, I had no idea what I'm doing. No idea. People are nodding, thank God. Because I didn't know, you know, and you just tell somebody to do what you've been told. So, you know, I've got my big book and we're reading through the big book together and I'm like, see this sentence, I have it underlined, you must underline it. Yeah. So, you know, you must underline this as well. And needless to say, it didn't work out that often. I mean, she pretty much ran. But I needed the experience, you know. You start where you start. So, let's see. I think it was about 7 or 8. You're 7 or 8 of my sobriety. My parents, by the way, from the get-go, my mom and my dad came to family week, or family whatever it was. My dad took notes. My dad, you know, he's got his doctorate. He's sitting there and he's taking notes. And you know, every once in a while, and you know, it's several years later, every once in a while, my dad gives me a call and he'll be like, Stephanie, do you have a sponsor? I guess, Dad, I have a sponsor. Stephanie, you sponsoring anybody? Yes, Dad, I'm sponsoring somebody. So you're still very involved. Yes, Dad, I'm involved. You know, it's really cool. I want to say it's only been the last two years, where my parents have forgotten my birthday. And the first year I wanted to be a little self-pity about it, like, you know. But what a gift. I mean, this past year, I like told them, you know, my sobriety date's coming up, you know, and blah, blah, blah. And I said, thank you. And they didn't remember. And it's so cool, you know. I mean, I'm just like the normal person like I should be, you know, a member of the family. I do want to say, though, that every holiday they will send an email. Or they'll call. If there's going to be any alcohol, they ask me if I'm okay with that. And I've had different people say different stuff about that. But I appreciate it because it's respect. It's respect for my disease. And I really do like that, you know. But anyway, so moving on. What was I talking about? Where am I? Oh, year seven or eight. I had come into the program in a relationship. We had separated our sobriety and our relationship for 6 months being in treatment. We actually had taken 3 of those months to go to couples counseling to get back involved in a relationship. We actually dated and all that kind of stuff. And the women from my treatment facility went on dates with us. And, you know, so they tried to set up a very healthy relationship. Because, you know, whatever. Well, it was dysfunctional as hell. But so through my sobriety, up until that point, this man had not been able to stay sober. And the most time he put together was about 4 years. And, you know, being a person that came in that didn't have anything, I started to have stuff, you know. My first sober job was a Waffle House waitress. Woo! Oh, come on. and I did that I actually was able to waitress myself through school. I got really tired of working jobs where I was getting paid $7 or $8 an hour, but, you know, I dropped out of high school when I was 17 because of, you know, the Papa John's manager. And so, You know, I had no education, I had no skills, I had no job history, so that's where I started, you know. And I got tired of doing that, so my husband at the time had suggested that I try to enroll in school, and I did. And I had taken the SATs, and I had, even though I had, and I had gotten my GED diploma, and I'd taken the ACTs. And I'm not saying alcohol helped me, but possibly, because I remember walking in there just drunk, and I had pulled a pencil out of my hair, and I was like, oh, and I did really well. So I actually, I got accepted into Kennesaw State University. And I had no idea what I wanted to do. And I was scared to death to even go to school. Like, I was like, these people are going to know, you know, I do not belong here, you know. And so my husband went with me, and we walked on campus, and I was quiet, and I was terrified, and he sat with me on the front row of this, like, introductory lecture, and he kept raising his hand, asking questions, and I was like, shut up, you know, like, they're going to find out we're here. yeah, and it was so cool, but with that little piece right there, it gave me freedom. You know, it gave me freedom. I was able to walk on that campus. I was able to, like, I'm not like him, you know. And I could ask questions and that kind of stuff. So I actually started to go to school. And as I started to progress in school, I needed to make money in kind of, like, different ways. I couldn't have a, you know, 9-to-5 job like I was used to having. And JJ down at the extension, he needed a typist for these evaluations he was doing. And he asked me to type. And so I was like, I can type. And I, believe me, when I walked on that campus, I had never seen a computer. You know, I had never been to, like, a library, a big, you know, the university ones are big, you know. And my first report ever, I wanted to do it on, like, Joan of Arc or something, you know. And my sponsor was like, write it on what you know. I'm like, I only know alcohol and drugs. She was like, write it on alcoholism. So I did. I wrote a paper on alcoholism. That was my first paper. And I got familiar with the computer. So by the time that I was far enough advanced, you know, somebody wanted to employ me, I was typing, and so I started to type evaluations for him. And about 6 months later, he asked me to be the first case manager down at the extension. They'd never had one before, and so I became the first case manager at the extension. And it was really great because it went with my work schedule. And then I found out, you know, I still hadn't declared a major, you know, so I decided to declare psychology. And that's how I started to kind of progress in my own life with a career. And, you know, our triangle, you know, we have the mind, the body, and the spirit. And my mind was definitely able to be, to grow because I was in school learning topics about philosophy and about history and learning how to study and stick to a deadline and keep schedules. And so all of that happened for me in that way. During college, I remember being stressed out about a test, and I walked into my professor's office, and she had kind of taken me under her wing. And she's like, oh, my God, Stephanie, you smell like a smokestack. And I swear, I used to smoke 2 packs a day Marlboro Reds. And I was embarrassed. You know, I was embarrassed. And so when we talk about the body, I started at that time to start running. And slowly the cigarettes, you know, started to go away. I started to be concerned more with my diet and the good things that I was putting in or not putting in. I had gained about 30 pounds eating chips, sitting in front of that computer doing papers. So I had no idea how to eat and how to, my knowledge of that kind of stuff was of an adolescent, you know. I could eat Cheetos and sit at my computer and smoke cigarettes and just wasn't drinking, you know. So I started then to also be concerned with my body. My spirit was developed, of course, through this program. You know, my sponsor had me from the get-go doing a step 10, and she had me immediately involved in tradition. I always was required to be at the group conscious. I was required to understand about tradition. And from the get-go, that's always been a part of my sobriety. Okay, so about year 8, he just couldn't stay sober. And I had all these positive things going. I was actually running at that time. I had progressed beyond the extension. I had chosen to get another job. And I was working for the state of Georgia. And I was managing an all-women's residential facility, and it was a hotty-totty position. And I had a woman who actually was not in recovery, but she was my first real friend, you know, like a real, it wasn't a one up, one down relationship, sponsor, sponsee. It was none of that. It was just a friend. And one night he didn't come home. We had a house, payments on that house. you know, I was in school. I had responsibilities with work, and he didn't come home again. He was supposed to be in Florida. And so I called my girlfriend, man, and I was like, what do you think about this? And she told me her opinion. I called my sponsor. I said, what do you think about this? And she told me her opinion. And, you know, one thing about this program, nobody has the say-so. You know, there's no leaders in this thing, you know. I love my sponsors, and I always have, and I've had a few, you know, but they aren't my God, you know. So I was able to take information from here, and I was able to take information from here, and I was able to talk to my parents, and I was able to pray, and I was able to come up with a decision that I was done. I was done. And this was a huge turning point in my sobriety. I can tell you until year 8 that although there were ups and downs, I think my sobriety was a cakewalk. I really do. And I did work on self, and it hurt, you know, and I progressed in my growth, and it hurt. And there was joys, and there was a lot of positive things that had happened up until that time. But it was a cakewalk compared to what I was about to do. That man came home, had a piece of paper which had no lawyer legitimacy, but I think he was just scared to death of me at that point. Because I was like, you're going to sign this piece of paper, the house is mine, you need to get the hell out. And I found out from that point forward he had lied tremendously about our finances, that my name was on a lot of paperwork I had no idea it was on. I was easily in $50,000 in debt I had no idea about, to include the IRS. And I just was doing what I was doing. I got really mad at God. I got really, really mad at God because I felt like I had done what this book had asked me to do. You know? And why is it, after all this that I've done, why is it that I end up here with this? This isn't right. I've done what you've asked me to do, you know? It took me a few years to get to the place to where I was dealing with God, a God that was still of my childhood. I was still like, if I do this, this equals this. If I'm not going to do this, this equals this. And it took me a really long time to get down to understanding that my concept of God was still really jacked up, you know? Today, I choose to have a God that is not like that. It is not a equal, you know, kind of God. God is all-loving, all-powerful. And what that means for me today is freedom, personal freedom. So I left him, and I started to deal with the debt. My sponsor at that time, God bless her, we used to have nights when I would call her at 2 in the morning, and she'd be like, okay, I'm going to tell you again, I used to have this bag on my kitchen table, and I would write sentences and turn them over and put them in that bag and shut the pantry door so I could try and get some sleep. I used to walk in these rooms, and I would sit at that back table right back there, and I had this woman, because I was so alone and so scared, she would just touch my hand, and I would cry, you know. It was a very hard time. Running got me through that too. Every morning, 5:30 in the morning, I would be down at Hobgood and I would be running, and that sun would rise and I could feel God on my face with the sun, you know? It got me through. Two years solid I ran until my knee hurt. you know, and it was kind of cool. My God set me up with, I had 4 sponsees at that time, all newcomers. Yeah, I was staying sober. I'll tell you, but you know, one of those sponsees from that time, she still runs. And another woman, my friend from the treatment facility, she runs marathons now. You know what I mean? Like, our little pieces of life, they spread, you know, to other people. It's really cool. I moved out to Oklahoma for a while. I had kids, you know, I'm a substance abuse counselor, and I had kids that I was working with, and they kept relapsing, and my husband would be in the room with my kids and me, and I realized that I was not being of service as a counselor, and so I left the field. I needed to heal. So I was like, what can I do? And I wanted to travel, so I got on a international flight attending job. Woo! And I did. I flew the world. And I literally would have AA meetings in the back of a jet, DC-10 jet. And I went to AA meetings where alcohol isn't even supposed to be served. I went in Iraq. Not even supposed to have alcohol. There's meetings. I went in Germany. I went I went everywhere. Paris, I went to so many places and got to do meetings. I did meetings online. I did sponsorship through emails. I was able to stay sober going anywhere and doing anything, damn it. You know? We can. We have the ability to do anything we want to do and do it sober, you know? And that was a blast. Struggled a little bit with it after about 6 months because the flight crews change a lot. And so I wasn't able to sustain relationships. And by this time, I've learned that intimate relationships is the only thing that is just worthwhile in life, you know? Being able to share and be a part of another person's life is where it's at, you know? That's what I miss. That's what takes away the loneliness, okay? God's a part of that, don't get me wrong, but I love people. I want to be a part of people. And so I miss that flying around. So I did my healing, and then I went out to Tulsa, Oklahoma, with a pilot. Beautiful man. But once again, God used my character defects to do what was best for me, and that is, while I always have had a love for the man, he knew that I needed to do some more healing on a lot of different levels. And so this gentleman, because he was an international pilot, was gone most of the time. And maybe 1 week out of a month he'd be there. And it was great. We'd like go out to eat and like, and then like he'd leave, you know, and I had the house, and it was just like, you know, exactly what I needed to be able to continue to heal. I ran drug courts out in Oklahoma. I did a lot of real positive things in my career. I developed a lot of relationships out there I still keep today, but I got tired of the stress. It was very stressful, my job, and JJ called me, and he said, do you want the women's facility? And I said, hell no. Been there, done that. So he said that, you know, he asked me to come back and to help him to be able to set up a retirement, and that felt really good to me. You know, he's given a lot of his time and attention to the extension, but they're a nonprofit, and he doesn't have a way to get a retirement. And I got a lot of respect for what he's done. And my career has been, it's awesome, but it's spread out over a lot, you know. So I decided that I would come back, and I did. I came back here. It's been, I guess, 3 years now. And I run his private practice, which is also going to be, you know, a part of his retirement. And I love my career. I see God all in my career. And AA is at the core of it. It really is at the core of it. We are not professionals. Don't get me wrong. I have learned therapeutic technique. However, my sobriety still impacts my career big time. I got involved with a gentleman from these rooms, and now I have a beautiful baby girl in diamonds. I'm married. And I got these for Christmas, more diamonds. I had a baby girl about a year and a half ago, and I'm almost done. We're running up on the hour. I gotta say that right around the time I had my daughter, I started to understand the impact of emotional sobriety. I started to, I found the, so weird, but I got an email from a lady. I had randomly put something out about my adoption, and that email from the lady said that there's an Open Records Act for Illinois. So I was able to locate the name of my mother, my birth mother, and that was tremendous. I'm starting to be able to take a look at my family relationships and understand the lack of intimacy. I held myself apart because I was adopted, and I have a tendency to do that in my current life. I've been able to take a look at some of my adoption baggage, and all of this is with a sponsor and with the help of these 12 steps. I, at year 14, have been told by my sponsor that it's time to now be an adolescent. So I get to learn how to be have intimate relationships, which for me is not comfortable. I'm doing a lot of reading right now on The Language of the Heart, Emotional Sobriety by Bill W. And I'm looking a lot at what dependencies I have on other people and the demands that I place on them to meet my dependencies. So it's a really different level of spirit than I've ever been involved with yet. My sponsor continues to tell me that I'm at exactly where I need to be, and it never fails. I will walk into a room of Alcoholics Anonymous with something on my mind, and God speaks to me. He speaks to me through everyone. And it doesn't matter if somebody in this room has 1 minute or 25 years. You never know where God's going to come from, but he's always in these rooms. I like to say that I am a product of AA. You know, hell, I came in here when I'm 22 years old. I'm 36 now. You guys are like a part of my life. You have shaped me. You have helped me to grow. I owe you my life, you know, my career. Just so my daughter is going to, you know, she's never going to have to know her mom drunk, ever, you know. And I keep getting better, hopefully, right, as long as I do these things. So I hope somehow, if anybody heard God today, that I've been a service to somebody somewhere in this room. And I want to read one more thing, and then I'm going to go. There is a solution. Chapter 2, page 17. We of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill. Nearly all have recovered. They have solved the drink problem. We are average Americans. All sections of this country and many of its occupations are represented, as well as many political, economic, social, and religious backgrounds. We are people who normally would not mix. But there exists among us a fellowship, a friendliness, and an understanding which is indescribably wonderful. We are like the passengers of a great liner the moment after rescue from shipwreck, when camaraderie, joyousness, and democracy pervade the vessel from steerage to captain's table. Unlike the feeling of the ship's passengers, however, our joy in escape from disaster does not subside as we go our individual ways. The feeling of having shared in a common peril is but one element in the powerful cement which binds us. But that in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. Thank you.